wrapping up our series on transformation. I think it's been 6 weeks or so. We started about the middle of August. A relatively short series, but if you remember, if you were part of it, in that first week, we had brought in one of our own students. She had just graduated last year, and she came in, and she's very gifted at art, and specifically pottery. She's just really good at what she does. And so we had Rachel come in, and we had her in front of us, and we had it projected on the screen. If you missed it, you can find that is on our website. And I got to think of the dates here. I believe, what did we have it on the, not the 18th, what was the week before the 18th? It's the 11th, I think. August 11th, I believe, was the date of it. You can go on. You can still watch what she did. But we started with that because what we found in Jeremiah chapter 18 was this remarkable picture, this remarkable story, where God says to his prophet Jeremiah, he says, Jeremiah, I want you to go down to the potter's house. I have a message that I want to give to you there. For those of you who have been with us every week, you're just like, okay, I'm tired of hearing you tell that story. But it's such an amazing picture, an amazing story. So Jeremiah goes down to the potter's house. And when he gets there, what he sees is the potter is working at the wheel. And Jeremiah gives us this picture, this description of what it is that he's seeing as he's working on the wheel. And he says, I saw the potter, he was working on the wheel, but the clay was marred in his hands. We're going to look at that one verse again this morning. And so it says the potter created a different pot or a new pot. And so we've been looking at this idea of transformation. Because let's be honest, every one of us, if we really are willing to open ourselves up and own this reality, are being transformed. And if we can't go there, it's like, well, I don't even know if that's the case, then we got to back up and say one step further, need to be transformed, okay? And I'm humbled to say, even this last week, I do things, and I just am ashamed of what I do sometimes. Like, what is wrong with me? And you look at it, and the Lord pointed out to me, it's like, oh, you know, thank you, but it's humbling to be in that capacity. And so I recognize that even I, in a weekly, daily, even basis, we need transformation. And so let's take a look at this, and that's what we've been doing, is we've been looking at this idea of transformation. So in the story of Jeremiah, he sends Jeremiah down to the potter's house, and Jeremiah watches what's going on, and then God gives him this message. He says, Jeremiah, I want you to understand something. See what that potter's doing with that clay? I'm the potter, and you are, in a sense, the clay. And in fact, all of Israel is the clay, and the point of it is, I am the one who gets to decide and choose what you will be. So we had Rachel here. She was throwing a pot on the clay, and she's the one that got to decide what it is that she was making. We had no right to be able to tell her, Rachel, this is what we want you to make, and she made what it is that she wanted to make. She formed it, okay? And in fact, she ran into a problem where there was this bubble in it, and she actually had to trim it, and she had to cut it. But if you watch what the potter does, he pushes it, and he pulls it, and he stretches it, and this is very uncomfortable. Could you imagine what the clay feels like? Because I don't want to be pushed and pulled anymore. Very interestingly, when we look at the true identity of this word, and we're going to look at it here just in just a moment, this true identity of the word formed, when God in Jeremiah says, is it not my right to form the potter, to form what it is that he wants to do? The literal translation means to be squeezed, okay? Is it not my right to form? Is it not my right to squeeze into shape that shape that I desire it to be? Let's look at this word. Hold on, there we go. There it is. So we looked at this briefly last week. So what we started with is the idea of God sending Jeremiah down to the potter's house. We looked at this idea of transformation. We followed up the following week. We had our baptism service, and we looked at this idea of how we can approach this God who is the creator. And the bottom line is we realize the clay has nothing to offer, right? The clay comes to the Father. It's like, I am empty-handed. I've got nothing. This is all your work. So the potter then puts the clay on the wheel. He starts forming it. We recognize we come to him with empty hands. The third then was this idea that not only do we come to him with empty hands, but if we resist what it is that he's doing, things don't go well. You know, I shared the experience of when I was in junior high, my first and only experience with the potter's wheel. It was part of art class. It went so poorly. I recognize art is not my thing. Okay. I mean, I was off-centered, and when you're off-centered and you're resisting that, what the potter's trying to do, the pot cannot be formed right, and so our job is to basically say, okay, I give up. I can't do this on my own. I can't be the one that's in charge because it's going against what it is that you want. And so we, in a sense, relinquish ourselves and allow him to pull us back into center and do that which only he can do. And then last week we looked at this idea of two things: who is God and who are we? And specifically last week we dealt with who am I, and we came to this consensus: we are created in the image of God. We are image bearers of his. Everyone in this room, everyone out of this room, whether you're going to the far reaches of the world and meeting people there that are in hardship, they are created in the image of God. Whether you're going to the city and looking at all the wealthy and the people living in the high-rise apartments and whatever else, they are created in the image of God. We are all created in the image of God. Whether you are Christian, whether you are Muslim, you are still created in the image of God. Now, there might be, there is, in fact, I will rephrase it that way, a misunderstanding of Jesus and who we are. But that doesn't diminish the idea that we have been created in his image. You follow that? That's an important thing to note. I'm not saying all religions are the same. That is not it. But we are all created to reflect his image. Okay. So that was last week. And now what we did, we looked at this idea of last week. So we have been created in his image. We are all image bearers. But now who is he? Who is this potter? And so let's look at a few of these. So we looked at this last week. It said the Lord God formed mankind, okay? The word here is yatah. Okay, that's the Hebrew word, and basically that's the idea that means to be squeezed into shape. And so in a sense, when God made Adam, he squeezed him into shape. All right. So the Lord God formed mankind from the dust of the ground. We looked at this. What a beautiful imagery where he spoke everything into existence, but he decided to squeeze mankind a little bit harder. Okay. And then he breathed his life into him. We touched on that a little bit last week, and the man became a living being. Now that word, okay, formed is the same word, and it forms a different context here or a different association, but the word potter is actually the same word as formed. So in other words, what we have is you have the squeezer and you have the squeezed. It takes on kind of two different forms in what it's meaning. So now when Jeremiah goes down to see the squeezer's house, okay, and I saw him working at the wheel, but the pot he was shaping from the clay was marred in his hands. So the potter formed it. Now, this is a different word for formed. I know some of you might be going, okay, you're boring me. Sorry, but this is remarkable because this is going to fit so well with what we're going to talk about in Isaiah. This word formed is a different word. So not, it's not the squeezing aspect of it again. This word here is actually this idea of restoring, making new. And isn't that something that's astounding? Because God, who is making us in his image, sometimes it takes some restoration, doesn't it? You know, you look at the car shows today. If anyone's going to go to the car show, just pay attention. Because what a beautiful imagery of restoration. Some of them, they'll have the old picture of what it used to look like, and then they have the new picture. It's just like, that is astounding how it's been restored and is made new. So that's what this is basically saying. So the squeezer has decided, just like, we have a problem with this thing. I need to do something to make this pot new. And that's what he does. So he formed it into another pot, shaping it as it seemed best to him. It's the same word that we find. Can you see it here? I don't see the word formed. Doesn't make any sense. I don't see the word potter in here. But the same word is actually used in this context as well in 2 Kings chapter 19. Have you not heard? Long ago I ordained it. In days of old I planned it. It's the word planned. It's the same word. And basically what this is saying then is the idea of God planning, God forming. He said, I have formulated this plan, and it's this forethought. It's not like I just squeeze something and see what shape it comes out into be. It's such intentionality with what he's doing when he forms us. We see that over and over again through this. Now I have brought it to pass, and so that you have turned fortified cities into piles of stone. Okay. Jeremiah chapter 1, same word here, formed, we see it. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. We'll look at this verse again here a little bit. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. This God that we're talking about, he's a squeezer. He's a former. He's the one that shapes these things. He's the one that plans these things. The blacksmith takes a tool and works with it in the coals. He shapes an idol with hammers. You'll find in the, I think it's in the NASB, it actually uses the word fashions. Okay, so the word shapes, the word fashions. It's a word that is intended, it's the same word. that we see all we've been looking at, but there's, again, such intentionality with what he's doing. When you're fashioning something with these tools, it's like a blacksmith, literally, taking a hammer and he's working on the anvil. He's making it into the shape that he wants to. And every strike with that hammer has such intentionality to basically form that which he is making. God is a very intentional God with what it is that he is forming. He forges it with his might, with the might of his arm. Uh-oh, we're going to lose it again. Where's Kim? Chris, help me. Just one. There we go. Okay, from his dwelling, can you stay there? Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Okay, from his dwelling place, he watches all who live on earth. He forms the hearts of all. Understand this. Okay, form. We look at, okay, God, here's God. He's making hearts. Okay, like mass producing like Henry Ford, right? There's a heart, set it aside. There's a heart, set it aside. That's not the picture that we have here because this is intentionality. He's formed each one of you in the hearts and what you're passionate about and what excites you. He's made it with such intentionality that is, okay, this one here belongs to you. I'll give that one to you. And this one here, all right, you got a little hard spot, okay? I'll give that one to you. And there's the idea is he shapes it with such intentionality. Every one of us, yes, we are image bearers, but we are bearers of his image with such an intentionality. It's remarkable. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained. It's the same word. Is this one working? Yeah. Thanks, Chris. You're amazing. That's right. All the days ordained for me were written in your book. Ordained is the same word. Basically, all the days that you have basically squeezed out for me and have laid in place for me, you set them aside ahead of time for me. And it was before one of them could even come to be. So the question is, who is this God? Who is God? I mean, we look about that. We talk about that. Who is this God that is the shaper? Who is this God that is the potter? So we're going to look at some attributes of God. And some of these, we're going to start with the big three. And one of the songs, the hymn that we sang, it used one of these words, which I was so encouraged by, because these are some words that's like, okay, I've heard these words before. They tend to be popular to be used, but they're big fancy words, and we don't always know what they mean. So we're just going to break them down briefly. Here's where we're going to go. We're going to look at some of these attributes. We're going to break them down. We're going to look at a few more attributes, give always some scripture references to each of them. But then I want us to look at a bigger picture, a bigger truth. And that, quite frankly, I don't know if I've ever been more excited about a message than this one. I really mean that, just because there's something just really magnificent going on here. And I find myself, as I look at this, like I have no words to express really what it is that I'm encountering. And so I got nothing to say. Okay? Well, what are you so excited about? I have no idea. Okay, so here's one of the words. Omnipotent. Oh, yeah, I've heard that word, or no, I have no idea what you're talking about. Omnipotent, it's very simple. Basically, it means all-powerful. It's a big, fancy, theological word. It means all-powerful, and we recognize that God is all-powerful. We'll look at that in a little bit. There's two other words that kind of form these big three. There's all kinds of these attributes, but there's these big three, big omni words that means all. And so omniscient, well, what in the world does that mean? That means that God is all-knowing, all right? So we understand the all-powerful part of it a little bit easier than we understand the all-knowing, okay? We understand that God is all-powerful. He can do all things. That, for our minds, it seems like we can grasp it a little bit easier. But when it comes to all-knowing, well, here's the thing. I'd like to have some secrets. And so I'd like to believe that maybe he doesn't know everything that's going on or doesn't feel like he knows everything that's going on. And so I have a little bit more trouble with that one. And then maybe we even have more trouble with the next one, which is omnipresent, which very simply means he is everywhere, okay? Well, how is that even possible? Well, he's God, okay? Just, and I know we look at these theological terms, and wow, that's just mind-bending. You're losing me here. Just stay with me, because there's some really powerful scriptures that illustrate this, and it helps us to lead into this one truth that I really want us to grasp, and you won't be able to. So omnipotent, very briefly. So Genesis chapter 1, we looked at this again last week. This is it's just a remarkable thing. We understand that God is all-powerful. This just exemplifies it. Because quite simply what we find in Genesis chapter 1, verse 3, it says God said, in other words, he speaks it, let there be light, and there was light. That's pretty powerful. I go around the house sometimes and I say, let the lights be off. And all the kids look at me and it's like, why are you talking that way? Dad, get up and go turn off the lights, okay? I'm trying to express this reality that too many lights are on in this house. I want to save energy. Go turn the lights off, all right? And I have no power to get them to go do what they do. And God can just say, I'm pretty sure maybe God invented the clapper, okay? Does anyone still have one of those? Those were really great. Okay. I remember with my grandmother, she had these, they were like Legos, but they were a little bit different, but there's other Lego toys. If you took the Lego toys and you took a big handful of them and you smashed them down, the lights would go on or off, depending. Okay. Job chapter 42, verse 2. Job says, I know that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. You ask, who is this that obscures my plans without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. And Job recognizes, man, God, you can do anything. Psalm 115, verse 3. Our God is in heaven. He does whatever he pleases. Jeremiah 32, verse 27. I am the Lord, the God of all mankind. Is anything too hard for me? It's simple. Simple is not the right word. It's easier for us to get our minds around this idea of God being almighty, God being all-powerful. It gets a little bit more difficult when we look at this idea of God being all-knowing. Maybe more uncomfortable would be the more accurate phrase. Psalm 139, we're going to spend a fair amount of time looking at different passages out of Psalm 139. We sang some of them, whether you recognize it in the songs this morning. Some of these passages were actually reflected through some of the music. This is an amazing chapter of the Bible. This chapter, if anything else in the Bible points to who this God is, it perhaps is really encompassed in this one psalm, in Psalm 139. Some of us are fairly familiar with it, perhaps others are not, but in starting in verse 2, it says, you know, this is God all-knowing, you know when I sit, you know when I rise, you perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you have laid your hand upon me. Talk about God being all-knowing. He knows what you're going to say before you say it. He knows when you get up. He knows when you lie down. He knows what you're thinking. Jeremiah chapter 1, we looked at this just a bit ago, but understand what the significance of what is being said here. Because it says, I formed you, right? Before I formed you in the mother's womb. So get this, before conception. Okay, before I did that literal forming, I already knew you. And do you see that pre-existence, God still know, and that's remarkable. Can any person do that? No. You know, when I remember when we had each one of our children, you know, I remember holding them and wondering literally, like, what are you going to be like? You know, you have no idea what their personalities are. You know, will I like you? Maybe. But you understand? I mean, there's just like, I want to know you, but I don't know you yet. Likewise, God is saying is the antithesis. I love using that word because it sounds so fancy. Okay, the opposite is true with him, where basically what he's saying is, before you were even there, I already knew you. I didn't have to want to know you. I already knew you. And that's astounding. And so then he says, I knew this is what you were going to be, Jeremiah. He says, before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet of the nations. I knew exactly who you'd be. I knew exactly what you'd do. Omnipresent. Okay, this means he is everywhere. This does not mean that God lives in the trees, all right? It's bigger than that. I mean, it's like God is present. He's not only is he here with us, he is with every other church that is basically meeting across the country who is worshiping him. He is there. He is present. Now, is God in the trees? No, it's more like he is through the trees. You follow? Psalm 139, there it is again. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? Okay, God, here's the deal. You know, okay, I love my children, but sometimes I need a break from my children, particularly when they won't stop fighting. That's a different song, okay? But here's this reality that sometimes I need a break, okay? And so what do? You go lock yourself in the bedroom. You go work out in the garage. You just go for a drive. Or you send them to their room. Okay, it doesn't really matter where, but sometimes you need a break. Well, this reality is you can never get that break in a sense like this. Where can I go to get away from you, God? And the answer is nowhere. You can't. That's not an option. And we look at that as like, well, maybe I want a break. Well, tough. You don't get one, okay? If I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. It's magnificent. Jeremiah 23:23-24 says, "Am I only a God nearby, declares the Lord, and not far away?" Remember, the context of this is basically Judah, the Jews, would have all been in exile in Babylon, and God used Jeremiah to be able to express to them some encouraging words. And so twofold is the idea on this, where God is saying to them is like, am I only God when I'm near? In other words, you guys are over in Babylon. Am I only God when I'm in Jerusalem? Like when you're with me in Jerusalem? And he's saying, that's not true. I'm both places, if you will. Okay. And likewise, then, am I only God when you feel like I'm close to you? It says, whether you feel me close to you or not doesn't diminish the fact that I am everywhere. I am God, and I am with you. No matter where you are, I am there. Who can hide in the secret places so I cannot see them, declares the Lord. Do not I fill heaven and earth, declares the Lord. Okay, so those are the three main ones. Just a few others that we're just going to touch on. There's more than we would have time for. Okay, but let's look at these. So we've obviously heard, we sang about it this morning again, God is righteous. Psalm 11:7 says the Lord is righteous. Very simple. Personal. God is a personal God. In Hebrews 1:1-3, it says, but in these days, God has spoken to us through his son. In other words, in the past, he spoke to the prophets. Now he's given to us this very personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And it's a personal, we have a personal God who wants to speak to us and interact with us. God is grace. This is one of my favorites. God was grace before Jesus, and even more grace since Jesus. So just understand what John is saying here. John 1:16, it says, out of his fullness, out of God's fullness, out of his completeness, we have received grace. We know that. We've heard that from when we were very little. We've received grace. But notice what it says then and thereafter. We've received grace in place of. So you've received grace instead of what? Let's look. You've received grace in place of grace already given. In other words, God is a gracious God. What he did is he just layered another layer of grace on top of the grace that he's already given. I mean, you look through the Old Testament, sometimes we think, oh, God's just a God of wrath. He's not. You see grace after grace after grace, and that's what Jesus Christ was. He laid on, this incredible grace upon grace that he was already gracious enough to give. Do you kind of grasp that? I know it can be difficult to get your mind around, but God is a God of grace, and it's grace upon grace, and it's just magnificent. God is merciful. Psalm 85:5. Lord, you are merciful and good. That's just a lot of attributes. And there's a lot more. You know, God is love. We could spend some time looking at that. God is just. But there's one that encompasses it all. And that's one that, honestly, we're going to look at, and you're going to leave here thinking, I have no idea. And that's exactly where I want you to be. Because I think, in truth, we don't have any idea. E.W. Tozer puts it this way, and he's absolutely right. So we're going to try to read through this fairly slowly, but this is an A.W. Tozer quote. I got it directly from the Christian Missionary Alliance website, okay? So they have it posted on their website. I don't remember where it was. I did a search for Tozer quotes. It took me to the Alliance website, okay? Here it is. So neither the writer, this is Tozer, and this would be referring to himself. Okay, so when Tozer writes, neither the writer, he's the writer. So neither the writer, neither himself, nor the reader, that would be us and or whoever first read it, neither the writer nor the reader of these words is qualified to appreciate the holiness of God. Okay, you are not qualified to appreciate God's holiness. I'm not qualified to appreciate his holiness. A.W. Tozer wasn't qualified. Mother Teresa wasn't qualified. Billy Graham, not qualified. Isn't that, I mean, right there, that's humbling. And we should, our awareness should be kind of awakened. It's like, seriously? These are some pretty godly people. Moses wasn't qualified. Abraham, not qualified to appreciate the holiness of God. Quite literally, Tozer says, a new channel must be cut through the desert. So we have our minds, and we're kind of set. We kind of believe, we kind of think we know what this holiness is. And he says, you're not even close. He said, your mind is like a desert, and you actually have to cut this channel where this information can even get through. And even in that, you're going to fall short. He says, a new channel must be cut in your minds to allow the sweet waters of the truth that will heal our great sickness, the sickness of not being able to understand his holiness, to flow in. We cannot grasp the true meaning of the divine holiness. I think we could stop there, but he gives some details. We cannot grasp the true meaning of the divine holiness by thinking of someone or something very pure. So you have a brand new baby. Okay? It's like pure. So wonderful. Now just envision that being much greater, and that's God's holiness. That still falls so short. I mean, not even close. So you think of the most beautiful thing. You think of the most pure thing. Anything you can think of in that regards, it cannot be compared to God's holiness. I was telling one of the elders kind of jokingly, I was like, I've tried to, I really wanted, and I did some studying, I did some thinking and some searching. I wanted to come up with some kind of an illustration that exemplifies God's holiness. You know what I came up with? Squat. Nothing. I couldn't find anything that really I felt would exemplify God and his holiness. Everything. It's like, well, that doesn't really work. That doesn't really work. So by thinking of someone or something very pure and then raising it to the concept of the highest degree we are capable of, God's holiness is not simply the best that we know, it's or even infinitely better than that. We know nothing like the divine holiness. In other words, nothing we can think of can compare to his divine holiness. It stands apart. It's unique. It's unapproachable. It's incomprehensible. And it's unattainable. The natural mind, the natural man is blind to it. He may fear God's power and admire his wisdom, but his holiness he cannot even imagine. We get just a glimpse, and I mean a glimpse. We're not getting a good picture of it, and I'm pretty sure that he didn't get it either. It's possible that Isaiah saw the full holiness of God, but I'm pretty sure he didn't. If he did, we think he would be dead. Now, God is all-powerful, so perhaps God could spare him his life. Maybe, but in the same capacity, I don't think he saw it, but we're going to look at it here briefly. So Isaiah chapter 6, this is one of the best pictures we have of what happens when we come into at least a mere glimpse of who God is in his holiness, and this is what it says. In the year that King Uzziah died, I, this is Isaiah who is writing it, saw the Lord high and exalted, seated on the throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. So Isaiah gets this picture of God. And it's a holy picture. And we're going to see his reaction here. But just to bring us up to speed, what was significant about this? Isaiah was a prophet. He's just coming onto the scene at this point. And King Uzziah died. Why was this significant? If you don't know your history, let's talk about some of the Hebrew history right now. King Uzziah became king when he was 16 years old. I'm sure we have some 16-year-olds in here. Could you imagine? All right, we need a leader for the church. Let's find the first 16-year-old we can. And you are now the king. Okay? Would you think back when you were 16? Would you feel like you would have been, yeah, I could be president? You ever think now, if you were president, like, what would you do? I mean, do you think you could handle the job? You know, sometimes you'd like to say, wow, we really need some character in such a way, and if I were the president, and I think about that, it's like, I couldn't do it. There's no way. Kim Jong-un would eat me before breakfast, okay? Just saying, I can't do the job that's being done there. And so I recognize my inadequacy. I think Uzziah as a king at 16-year-old probably felt the same, felt incredibly inadequate, and that was probably a good place for him to be. He became king at 16 years old. He ruled for 52 years, and he started out so strong. In 2 Chronicles 26, this is what we see. He, this is Uzziah, did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father Amaziah had done. He sought God during the days of Zechariah, who was a prophet before Isaiah, who instructed him in the fear of the Lord. As long as he sought the Lord, God gave him success. Uzziah was a great king. I mean, to rule in Israel for 52 years, that's pretty good. And in that process, really what he did is he built an army. I believe the numbers were he had an army that was around 300,000. And the U.S. Army right now is just under 500,000. We have a big country. Now, that doesn't include Air Force. It doesn't, so just, I'm spinning the stats a little bit, okay? But that's just army. And so, basically, you look at a small country like Israel, and what King Uzziah was able to do, nearly put together an army, a ground army, much like, not far from what the U.S. has now. That's astounding. He built up walls. He built up towers. Israel was well defended. Israel was doing extremely well. And that kind of went to his head, as we see in 2 Chronicles 26. So after Uzziah had done all this, Uzziah became very powerful, and his pride led to his downfall. He was unfaithful to the Lord, his God, and he entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. So here's what Uzziah did. He's king of Israel. He's been king for a long time. It's like, you know, I think I know what's going on. I think I know how to do things. I don't need the priests to do this anymore. They're not around. I'm going to go. I'll do the burning of the incense. Well, that was against the rules. It had to be the descendants of Aaron. It had to be the Levites that actually went in and did this stuff. And so Uzziah, in his arrogance, goes into the temple. He takes the incense burner. Why can't I think of the name of it? Censer, thank you. I wanted to say cistern. That's different, okay? The censer, and he's got it lit on fire, and basically, so he's ready to go and offer the incense, and Azariah comes in there, and he's one of the priests. He says, what do you think you're doing? Well, I'm burning incense. You can't do that. Well, I'm king. Don't tell me what I can and can't do. I, in a sense, am the sovereign. I am the high ruler. You will listen to what I say. And Azariah stands in there and says, no, you can't do this. What you're doing is wrong. And he actually gets 80 other priests to stand between him and the holy place to say, you can't do this. And what does Uzziah do? Oh, I guess you're right. No, he gets angry. He says, who do you think you are? Do you not know my authority? Do you not know how high and how lofty I am? And guess what happens? He gets burdened with leprosy, and he has leprosy till the day he dies. He has to rule from his house, not even in the palace anymore. He has to rule from basically a closet, if you will, and kind of send messages or whatever. He still is king, but he's struck with leprosy, and he has that till the day he dies. So that's what Israel has just encountered, and it makes a little bit more sense then when you look at what we're finding here. So the day that King Uzziah dies, God's going to do something different. He's going to raise something up. He's going to do something astounding. And so he brings up prophet Isaiah in that setting. And Isaiah gets this picture. Watch. So above this man sitting in this throne, above the Lord, he sees seraphim, each with six wings. With two wings, they're covering their faces. With two wings, they're covering their feet. And with two, they're flying. If you remember the story in Moses, you know, remember Moses at the burning bush, God says, Moses, take off your sandals, you're standing on holy ground. I think that's kind of why the feet are covered, in the sense where those seraphim are not worthy to be standing, like to be in the presence of God, okay? Not only that, they got two wings that they're covering their eyes with. They're covering their faces. Is it possible that God's holiness is too great for even these angels to look at? I think God's holiness could be that big. That's huge. And it says with two they're flying. And then watch what they're saying. And they were calling to one another. Here they are, covering their faces, their feet, they're flying. It's like, oh, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. That's all they can say. They say, oh, you're righteous, you're just, you're good. All that's true, but they're looking at it, all that is encompassed in this one attribute. You are holy. I can't even look at you. The whole earth is full of your glory. So at the sound of their voices, the seraphims, and this is not even God's voice, at the sound of the seraphim's voice, there's great, the doorposts are shaking, the threshold shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. You know, it's interesting, the seraphim, I think the literal translation would basically mean like men or angels of fire, okay? Like, that's a pretty remarkable sight, right? And Isaiah sees this, and I think it's just a glimpse of God's holiness. He sees this, and he says, woe to me, for I am ruined. I think this would be the moment for Isaiah that it would be totally appropriate to say, without using the Lord's name in vain, to say, oh my God, I had no idea. And we use that phrase fairly flippantly, you know, but I just want you to understand, this would be an appropriate time to look at this picture and say, oh my God, I had no idea that's what holiness was. I think Isaiah sees just a glimpse of it. And he's, what's his reaction? I'm ruined. I can't leave this place and live. I'm just done. In the midst of God's holiness, Isaiah suddenly sees himself in a very real and an unattractive picture. He sees his own depravity. He says, I'm ruined. Oh, my lips are so unclean. The things that I say are trash. And he was the mouthpiece of God. That's what's so fascinating about what he's saying here, because he's the prophet. The prophets were the mouthpieces of God. So when God says something, they say it out. They were considered like, listen to what the prophet has to say. And so here's Isaiah, and that's his tool. My tool is messed up. I'm ruined. My mouth is nasty. This nation's mouth is nasty. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. There's so much here. Okay, so just look at what this passage says and let this reality sink in. So Isaiah's come in, he recognizes his depravity, and now watch what happens. It's just the first time this has ever happened, and it totally flips everything that we knew up to this point on its head. Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. Okay, is anyone grasping what's going on here? Because this is really cool, right? With it, he touched my mouth. See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for. Okay, up until this point, every time we see the altar, we see God, it's mankind that's bringing a sacrifice and laying it on the altar and giving it to the Lord. This is the first time that we suddenly now see God taking something from the altar and giving it to mankind. Isn't that? You see that? That's life-changing. That right there is life-changing. This holy God who is encompassing all of these amazing attributes. And let's be honest. We don't take very much time to consider God in his holiness. You know, we like him as a friend, and he is. I'm not saying that. We like him as a loving God. We don't take much time to reflect on, like, wow, if I look at that much longer, I'll be blind. Okay? So this is the first time then the seraphim comes. It takes the coal from the altar and takes it over to Isaiah and touches his lips. And then this is a beautiful picture. See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away from your sins have been atoned for. This is a picture, the first one that God gives to Isaiah of what he's going to do with the redemption. And it's in this book of Isaiah. We find it in chapters like Isaiah chapter 9, Isaiah chapter 53, where God then continues what has happened here by actually telling Isaiah of this Messiah, of this Jesus Christ that's going to come, that kind of does what Isaiah just experienced. It's just remarkable. It's also interesting to note, after this moment in Isaiah, how you find Isaiah referring to God in the book of Isaiah, he'll say things like, the Holy One. His language changes. It isn't just the Lord anymore. It's just like the Holy One or the Holy God. He recognized this has transformed him when he came into the presence and he saw this holy God for who he really was. He can't go back to just thinking God as one way that he used to. Now it is different, and he looks at this. It's like, holy, you're holy. I had no idea. And it's absolutely life-changing. And then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And Isaiah's response is, I'll go. Okay? After just having that encounter. And we've taken this sometimes in the church, and we look at, well, you need to, you know, missionary work. This is bigger than that. It's like, who will serve me? Who will live for me? Who is it? I have a message to give. Who will give my message? And Isaiah's, I'm in. You know, my mouth was nasty. My mouth was dirty. You have atoned for that. I'm in. I'll give your message. He's the first to volunteer. He doesn't even know what the request is yet, you know? Your questions as we kind of wrap up. Have you encountered the Holy One? I don't think anyone has seen literally God's holiness, because if you had, you wouldn't be here. Okay? I just totally think that if you saw God and his holiness for what it truly is, you would probably be dead. We even see it when Moses requests, he said, God, I just want to see you. Show me your face. And God says, Moses, you've been with me a long time now, and you're a fool. Okay? Because if you saw my face, you'd be dead. This is Moses. I mean, it's astounding. And so he said, but I tell you what I will do. I will shield my glory from you as I pass by with my hand so that you can see the train of my robe. And even that, when Moses goes down the mountain, is like still shining, okay? We have no idea. So if you're here saying, yeah, I've seen God's holiness. No, you haven't. Sorry. But have you encountered the Holy One? There's a difference there. Have you come to this reality? It's like, man, you're holy. What's my response to that? Your response can really only be one thing. Where'd I go? Oh, hold on. It was my fault. Have you come to see your own depravity? Have you come to see, just as Isaiah's words now, have you come to see, I'm ruined? You know, because when we come in face to face with God and His holiness, our response has to be, wow, you're so holy. I am nothing close to holy. Have you come to grips with that? And then, it's real simple because Isaiah lays it out. This is the gospel message. He lays it out in the Old Testament, and I just love it. He says, have you received the cleansing grace? Have you recognized, God, you're holy? I'm not. I keep messing up. Have you just said, I thank you for your grace? That's all Isaiah did. Isaiah didn't say, God, would you take one of those coals and touch my lips? Would you do that for me? He doesn't even do that. Basically, all Isaiah says, I'm ruined. And God takes the initiative and takes the coal from the altar and says, guess what? I'm offering you grace. Now, fully, Isaiah receives the grace. Because the angel said, here, touch this to your lips. And he does, and he's cleansed. It's a beautiful picture. Have you received cleansing grace? And then the final part of it is, and we see it in Isaiah, have you made yourself available to him? I know these are like, you know, yes and no questions. But the questions that really, if we're willing to engage into them, they should lead us into this reaction, this transformation relationship with Jesus Christ. Because if I haven't come to interact, to encounter that Holy One, that's got to be where it starts. And then when I encounter that Holy One and I recognize how much I really am depraved without Him and I need Him, that's where it continues. And then it's like, I have no choice but to receive the grace of Jesus Christ. That's where it continues. And my only response then thereafter is like, oh, Lord, whatever you need. It's kind of encapsulated in one final verse. This is the last slide that I have. Luke chapter 9. And Jesus said to all of them who were there, he says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny himself and take up their cross and follow me daily. Okay? This is real simple. We have to come to kind of grips, come to this realization, oh God, you're so holy. We have to kind of do that on a daily basis. You know what I'm saying? Like, Lord, it never comes back to me and my goodness like it happened to Uzziah. Instead, it's like waking up as a 16-year-old king saying, I have no idea what I'm doing. I can't do what I do without you, Lord. So please, you do it. I recognize you and your holiness. I want to submit to you and your holiness. This is life-changing. This is life transformation. I'm going to invite Lane and the worship team to come up. And as we worship at the end, I want you to reflect on those four questions. Have you encountered the Holy One? Have you come to understand in that encountering that you're ruined? Have you responded to his offer, his gift of grace? And then it's like, will you make yourself available? Reflect on those as we worship.
Let's stand and sing this last song, Reckless Love.